I'm grateful to Teresa for that lovely introduction, and I'd like to thank the St. Anselm Institute, the Thomistic Institute, and the Center for Christian Studies for this invitation to come to this wonderful university and to speak to you today about Christianity and our responsibilities in the public square. Teresa mentioned in her introductory remarks the metaphysical consensus that seems to have eroded or maybe even disintegrated in the last couple generations. Father Thomas Joseph White or other outstanding Dominicans would far better address you on that in that mode with respect to that need. My vocation as a Christian thinker is to be in the borderline between public affairs and practical, almost, shall we say, partisan politics and reflection. And so what I want to do today is to speak about populism, our political moment, and try to frame it in a, put it in a larger frame of reference so that we can think about it more responsibly and more intelligently, and then respond to it in a way that is fitting given the realities that we face. So that's the framework for this talk. When Teresa invited me, I negotiated for the broadest possible title for my talk because I was working on a book on this question of what I've... it's a book on the post-war era. And whenever I say post-war and I look around and I see young people, I have to tell them that means post-World War II, which is a sign that an era is coming to an end when post-war does not automatically mean post-World War II. So it's my conviction that we're at the end of an era, that a lot of our political distempers flow from the dominance of a certain way of thinking, a certain consensus that emerged after 1945. And so my purpose today is to say I worked on a book, I finished the draft of the book, and what I'm going to try to give you is a sort of distillation of some of the observations that I conclude the book with. So, without further ado, in 1912, Emile Durkheim published an account of the social function of religion, titled The Elementary Forms of Religious Life. As he recognized, formal religious practice and belief constitute only part of our engagement with the sacred. Monotheism, Jewish and Christian monotheism, drove out the gods of nature and society, drove them out of the West, denouncing them as idols. Worship was to be reserved for the one true God above. But this disenchantment always remained partial, and it must always remain partial. There can be no society, this is Durkheim, there can be no society which does not feel the need of upholding and reaffirming at regular intervals the collective sentiments and collective ideals that make its unity and its personality, end quote. And this upholding and affirming draws upon the power of the sacred. This is Durkheim's claim in that magisterial work. Now, Durkheim's theory is a sociological one, not a theological one. But it is not discordant with a biblical view of the matter. As St. Paul writes in his letter to the Romans, let every person be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, governing powers are certainly not deities, but their dictates are tinctured with divine legitimacy. Something similar obtains for cultural norms. Wedding vows and public oaths invoke what is unchanging and permanent, calling it down, if you will, to bind the changeable and fickle course of human affairs. Myth and legend accumulate to articulate the sacred sources of a social compact. Even modern countries like the United States have founding fathers. Of course, this university's founding father, Thomas Jefferson. And they are real men with flaws, as we certainly know, but they somehow are imbued with a greater than merely human authority. Now, Durkheim thought deeply about the cultural dislocations, thought deeply about the cultural dislocations and psychological disorientations brought by industrialization and urbanization. And Durkheim thought that the West was going through a transition. People no longer thrilled, as he put it, quote, to the great things of the past which filled our fathers with enthusiasm, end quote. The late 19th and early 20th centuries were times of ambivalence and uncertainty. Loyalties were being withdrawn in search of new but yet unfound devotions. In a word, Durkheim wrote, the old gods are growing old or already dead, and others are not yet born. So, as one of the founding fathers of modern social science, Durkheim was tempted by a vision of knowing without believing, of seeing without affirming. This is the great temptation of the modern intellectual, is to see but not affirm, to know but not to believe. Yet Durkheim's critical powers and his freedom from the illusions of rationalism delivered him from the paradoxical utopianism of imagining that societies can endure on facts without myths, authority without rituals, and reality without dreams. Quote, this state of uncertitude and confused agitation cannot last forever, end quote. Men always rally around the sacred. A day will come, this is him again, in his mode of scientific prophecy, a day will come when our societies will know again the hours of creative effervescence. So, the death of the old gods in no way means the death of the sacred. We are social animals, and public life requires the aroma of the sacred. Now, Durkheim died in 1917, living only long enough to see the first intimations of the fierce new gods that would storm through Europe with fire and steel, ultimately drawing the better part of the world into war. It's my historical thesis, and this is the gravamen of the book that I finished recently. My historical thesis is that the generation that lived to the decades spanning 1914 to 1945 wished to put a stop to the socio-religious dynamic of the sacralization of public life that Durkheim thought kind of an inevitable element of what it means to be human. They wanted to somehow short-circuit that process. Driving out the strong gods was Karl Popper's explicit project in The Open Society and Its Enemies. It was written during World War II. And Popper urged meaning. It's funny, if you look at Google Word, you can see word usage, that in 1945, the use of the word meaning starts to spike up. And then throughout the 50s, it rises very rapidly, the use of the word meaning. It's a weak god. And he wants to push to the margins the word truth, which is a strong god. And I think we see this worked itself out in our intellectual culture over the last seven decades. His cadres of leaders were to be what he called social technologists and not poets or orators. And Friedrich Hayek, something of a hero of the American right, also wrote a wartime book, The Road to Serfdom. And his approach differed from Popper's. He prized the spontaneous order of the free market. It promises an order without authority, which is to say, a society without gods. But his central judgment was the same as Popper's. The West can only escape bloody cycles of self-destruction if we block our all-too-human impulse to consolidate around shared loves and shared loyalties that are what is evoked by the strong gods. So in two different ways, they were very influential, I think, in the post-war era. In two very different ways, they outlined thoroughgoing strategies of disenchantment. And this disenchantment was meant to keep the strong gods at bay. Maybe you can sort of entertain these things in a private sphere, but the public sphere was supposed to be weakened, calmed, made less fraught. And our liberal tradition encourages that also, as well. So this consensus emerged not in direct consequence of reading Popper or Hayek, perhaps, but instead of a broadly shared sense that the catastrophic years between 1914 and 1945 had to be countered by strong medicine that paradoxically needs to weaken the allure of the sacred and its strong making powers. So it's a kind of a paradox. This is a very strong consensus, but the consensus is we should not consolidate around strong things. And this is an understandable response, it seems to me, to what I call the Shoah of 1914 to 1945, disaster of those decades. Men do horrible things in the service of strong gods. And so would it not be better to live without strong gods, whether they be old or new? Would it not be better? Isn't skeptical doubt safer than faith and devotion? Isn't a thoroughgoing and an unending critical disposition for the best? Aren't we better off with an anti-dogmatic spirit? Or if we must have gods, shouldn't they be weak ones, not strong ones? Say the weak gods of difference and dialogue and diversity and other motifs of openness. These are all what I would call weak gods that are very much prominent in our time. Or they can be the weak gods of efficiency, productivity, utility, or other bloodless metrics that leave us unmolested by transcendent aspirations. Now, I sympathize with these questions, for I too fear the power of the sacred in public life. But I would submit that it is perilous to try to live against the grain of our humanity. Durkheim was correct. To be human means seeking transcendent warrants and sacred sources. As a consequence, there is a dangerous paradoxical utopianism in a too rigidly anti-utopian outlook. The battle against ideological bewitchment can itself become ruthlessly ideological. It can lead to a totalitarianism of critique, or, as Pope Benedict puts it, a dictatorship of relativism. And we see as much in our own time in a hectoring political correctness and other paradoxically hardened and inflexible expressions of an anti-dogmatic dogma. We live in a very paradoxical time. The obligatory weak gods, diversity, dialogue, difference, or utility, kind of economism of utility. So I would submit, no, we are not safer with never-ending critique. When the open, diverse, and inclusive society becomes an enemy of shared loyalties, when critical intelligence enters into total war against anchoring convictions, then our spiritual, cultural, and political consensus becomes anti-human. And I believe that this is what has happened in the West in the 21st century. And it has sparked disruptive, anti-establishment, populist revolts. Tonight, it is my thesis that we as Christians should seek to guide these populist revolts and not to try to stymie them. The problem, then, that we face, why do I draw this conclusion, this affirmation, if you will, of a guarded affirmation of populism because of the problems, I think, that we face, which are quite severe. At every turn, we find solidarity in marriage, nation, and church increasingly inaccessible. These are three modes of concentration, if you will. They consolidate us. They focus loyalty and establish borders and walls in a certain sense. We can maybe talk in the Q&A. So I'm trying to give some, if you will, reflective understanding of the political debate that, elements of the political debate that we face, one of which is this wall notion, which I think has a really crucial kind of metaphysical valence to you. It's obviously not a policy debate. It's obviously kind of got deep symbolism that both sides of the debate feel very intensely about. And so part of what I'm trying to do is kind of bring this out for us in my own language. So we've got marriage, nation, church. I mean, marriage obviously is a boundary, it's a boundary of fidelity, family loyalty, and so on. And then nation, and then church. Outside of the walls of the church, there is no salvation. That's the kind of classic wall statement. But I would propose that tonight we're going to focus almost exclusively on the nation, because it is at the forefront of today's political turmoil, and it's the most immediately political question among those three forms of loyalty. So the banishment of the strong gods from the public square means, I would submit, that the most important questions of our time go unanswered. My sense is this is part of why everything's so frightening right now politically, is because we're not asking the actual questions that need to be asked, and insofar as we do it in a halting way because we're not trained to ask them. And here's some of the questions that I think we need to ask. Can we make the global economy work for middling folks in the West? Or are we able to restore a shared moral community that protects the undisciplined among us from their own tendencies towards self-destructive vices? Or how should we respond to mass migration? Or should there be limits to globalization? And if so, set by whom and toward what end? In a certain sense, we could probably brainstorm and come up with many other kind of questions that we think are the important ones. They revolve around a deeper question. And that is, what is the role of the nation in the 21st century? Now, these are not questions for the seminar room, although they certainly can be for the seminar room, but they're not to be limited to the seminar room. They need to be at the center of public debate because they bear upon the future of the West. The cohort of foreign-born residents in the United States is now estimated at nearly 15% of the total population, the highest level in more than 100 years. Under these circumstances, only a person ignorant of human nature and our innate desire for stability, familiarity, and continuity can cheerily reiterate the win-win promise of diversity. In some European countries, the strain is even greater because so many migrants are Muslim. So it just seems obvious that there are always cultural and political limitations to pluralism. And a deconsolidated, fragmented nation can be as great a threat to human dignity as an over-consolidated and conformist nation. In truth, it poses a far greater threat, as refugees from Syria can testify. The problems of our time touch upon the essential question of public life. Who are we? What are the common loves that we share? What communal loyalties properly demand sacrifice, our sacrifice? And whom among us belongs to the we? Unfortunately, we have inherited a political, moral, and even spiritual consensus that broadly rules out these questions as illicit and dangerous. In an open society, they must not be asked, much less answered, for they lead to fascism, or so we are told. In Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, a book from 2008 by Christopher Caldwell, he reports the remarks of a European politician in the early 21st century. This man said, quote, "We live in a borderless world in which our new mission is defending the border, not of our countries, but civility and human rights." This is indistinguishable from the way in which Pope Francis and many Catholic bishops now talk. Now, for the free market libertarian, there's another way in which these questions get ruled out. I mean, on the left, these questions will lead to fascism if you're a European, or racism if you're an American. We have racism, they have fascism, and those are the two reductio ad absurdums, the two legitimate threats viewed as a legitimate peril that has to be guarded against. The right has other strategies for sort of sidelining the we questions. For the free market libertarian, the miracle of spontaneous order in market exchange means that we need not ask or answer the question of the we. Free trade will knit the world together, and something like Paul Samuelson's theory of price factor equalization shows that the market will eventually sort out the disequilibria brought by globalization. If we're just patient, the market will solve our political problems, which means that we don't really need politics at all. It seems to me that Durkheim was correct. In every political culture, the we touches upon sacred things. Human beings are by nature social animals, but the particular we is a gift, miraculous in its ability to turn what is contingent into something precious. The agony of the West in the 21st century rests in the crisis of the we, which is also a crisis of the sacred. For the we is real only insofar as we are united around shared loves and loyalties. So I want to begin an effort to recover the we with a fundamental definition. A republic is not a system of government. It is what is held as a public good among a particular people, a race, a thing, publica, a public thing. It is a commonwealth in which the weal or good is enjoyed and cherished in common. As Augustine recognized in his great account of world history, The City of God, a mass of individuals becomes a nation only insofar as the many are made one in a common love. In his definition, quote, "A people is an assembled multitude of rational creatures bound together by a common agreement as to the objects of their love." This is a good way, it seems to me, St. Augustine's definition is a good way to gloss Durkheim's notion of the gods of public life, which was his concern. They are not golden idols or characters in ancient mythologies. Sociologically speaking, a public god is that which has the power to evoke love. This love is always eccentric. It impels us outside ourselves, breaking the boundaries of me-centered existence. Love seeks to unite with and rest in that which is loved. This outflowing of the self makes love the engine of solidarity. The strong gods of public life are quite simply the objects of our shared public loves. The strong gods are whatever arouse in us an ardor that impels us beyond our me-centered frame of reference and causes us to wed our destinies together as a we. That's my kind of definition of a strong god. It comes on page 9 of the talk. It should come at the beginning, but I apologize. We're entering a time of political crisis, I believe. This is happening because we have inherited a cultural moral consensus that is fearful of love. In the shadow of Auschwitz, the post-war generation feared love's passions, for they can lead to destructive devotions. Love inflames ambitions, some of which impel us towards evil ends. Love urges sacrifices, some of which are misguided and self-destructive. At their worst, perverse loves can beckon us to sacrifice others. Our consensus in favor of openness and multiculturalism seeks to prevent these dangers by depriving us of love's objects. Its techniques of disenchantment, typically on the left, or technocratic wonkery, more on sort of the right, try to banish the strong gods, or at least make them weak and unable to rouse our hearts. One side of this consensus adopts strategies of critique and deconstruction, showing that a great deal of what the Western tradition has championed as fitting objects of our love are, in fact, sullied with injustice and are thus unworthy. Any students at any contemporary university are very aware of this, these techniques and strategies of critique and deconstruction. Now, as I said, we associate it with the left. On the right, we find a reduction of public life to market principles. In this way of thinking, civic life is an efficient system of private interests and not a moral community of shared loves. Both of these elements, whether it's kind of reduction to economics or a kind of disenchanting critique, they both work against the strong gods, and that's one reason why they're not really at odds with each other. I mean, that's why sort of you can do the sort of radical critique at UVA and then become a McKinsey consultant, because these are not fundamentally at odds with each other, and they both emerged out of the same cultural milieu of fear of the strong gods and an attempt to weaken them. And these strategies work against the strong gods, and both have succeeded in desacralizing public life, at least among our elite educated ruling class. In doing so, the Open Society consensus and its other variations has brought great calm to the West, and great wealth as well. I don't want to sell it short. The last 75 years have been marked by real achievements. There has been but one war in Europe since 1945, and it was on the margins in the Balkans. The calm continues to dampen dangerous upsurges of discontent in the core nations of the West. Paris sees regular marches in the streets. Italy careens from coalition government to coalition government. Germany anguishes over its history. Populism roils elections. Yet there are no paramilitary organizations marching in the streets. There are no brown shirts and no red brigades. After Trump's election, insofar as people were in the streets, it was a women's march with ridiculous hats and a great deal of therapeutic self-care. I'm not against therapeutic self-care, but these are not disruptive political events. But this project of peace without love, I would submit, cannot go on much longer. Man was not created to be alone. We do not desire calm, not even when satiated by countless pleasures. We yearn to join ourselves to others, not just in matrimony, but in social bonds as well. The we arises out of love, a ferocious power that seeks to rest in something greater than the self. In the first half of the 20th century, perverse nationalist and ideological loves destroyed a great deal of the West. Not just lives and buildings, but the cultural legitimacy as well. It's not surprising that the Open Society imperative gained the upper hand. But the death camps, gulags, atomic bombs, and killing fields, however horrible, did not destroy human nature. Our hearts remain restless, They seek to rest in loyalty to strong gods worthy of love's devotion and sacrifice. And our hearts, I would submit, will in fact find what they seek. And I think we see this in our political culture today. The strong gods are returning, and they're returning in populist concerns about immigration, borders, and national sovereignty. As I said, I focus on the nation because that's where the action is, it seems to me. Political tussles over the wall, as I mentioned, epitomize a deep, almost metaphysical debate about this return. Some see it as crypto-fascist or racist, a harbinger of renewed xenophobia or other sins of the closed society. This is not an irrational fear. Perverse loves of the dark gods are real dangers, not the least because these perverse loves will be fueled by the Chthonian, the kind of earth-oriented preoccupations with race and sex that so preoccupy progressives today. I mean, white nationalism is an almost guaranteed upsurge in the current identity politics environment. And, you know, if you think about the deconstructive, all the deconstructive techniques go down. They all go down, down to my groin or into my DNA or in some way down and not up. And so, you know, our educational culture has really plowed the fields for the emergence of very dark gods, it seems to me, because it is a critique that goes down, a dialectic that goes down. But the methods of weakening, I would submit, have reached their end. Only ennobling political loves, I would submit, will protect us from the debasing loves. So, the better way forward requires us to be forthright in asking a fundamental question, which is the fundamental question of politics. Who are we? It's a fundamental question of politics. Samuel Huntington's book of that title, was it Who We Are? Who We Are? I can't remember exactly. His final book, which was decried as a kind of crypto-racist treatise, I think was correctly recognized that after the end of the Cold War, which had a consolidating effect on the nations of the United States and other nations in the West, at the end of the Cold War, things were going to start to fragment and come apart, and that it was important then to sort of re-engage this fundamental political question. And as a side note, I would just say we need to ask the question of what it means to be a man or a woman, as well as a question about whether God exists and what I'm supposed to do about it. But I'll say a little bit more of that later. Now, answering the we question in public life requires an ongoing conversation and not short creedal statements. I'm opposed to the creedal nation notion, at least narrowly conceived. And it certainly involves more than, it certainly does not involve DNA tests. In the context of significant immigration and demographic change, it is more important than ever to have this conversation. It needs to include assessments of our modern democratic traditions. The we conversation must engage the role of biblical religion. It has to do justice to the land and its influence on our collective imagination. And the we has many historical strands and local instantiations. The we in Mobile, Alabama is not the same as the we in Seattle, Washington, though both are part of the American we. I would submit that the crisis of our time is one of solidarity, and the conversations that we need to have are strengthening ones. We need to have strengthening conversations, not weakening conversations. This means we should resist claims that conversations about injustice, or for that matter, if you're on the right, debates about how to increase economic growth, we need to reject the view that these conversations are the most important ones to have. They are relevant to the health of a republic, by all means, but making them primary weakens the we and impedes our ability to have that strengthening conversation, who are we? Trying to answer together this question, who are we? Populism, I would submit, arises because our leadership class insists upon the primacy of weakening conversations. They have become the sole focus of higher education, I would submit. In public life, the center left in the United States insists upon the perils of racism, while the center right fixes on tax rates. This represents a very real political difference, but it operates within the same single consensus. It's the consensus that seeks to weaken the strong gods. And this consensus has become dangerously out of step with today's political realities. It deters us from talking about what really matters in the 21st century, not just the United States, but in many nations of the West. And that is talking about our shared loves and how to renew them. To get a sense of how far things have come in recent decades, compare Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail with the Black Lives Matter website. King frames civil rights in the strengthening we affirmations that he derives from the Bible and from the founding documents of the United States. Black Lives Matter frames civil rights in terms of a weakening intersectional narrative of oppression. Fundamentally different, if you will, frames for the question of civil rights, or fundamentally different frames for thinking about the injustice of racial discrimination. I think it's hugely important, that difference. We could talk about it perhaps more in the Q&A. When it comes to the strong gods of public life, we're sure to go wrong. Modernity encourages us to overinvest our hearts in politics and in the nation, which is why ideological passions are so easily triggered. We imagine that the nation is more than our civic home, becomes our savior, and this makes us vulnerable to the inflated promises of false gods. To combat these false and dehumanizing gods, we need to nurture more humane forms of the we. You got civic associations, Boy Scouts, local theater board, but they have become increasingly weak in most of our society. Bowling Alone, Robert Putnam's observations there. As a consequence, we're thrown back upon the two primeval bonds of solidarity, the domestic society of marriage, and the supernatural community of the church, synagogue, and other communities of transcendence. They are crucial. Marriage and these communities of transcendence are crucial for moderating the modern tendency to overinvest in the nation and its strong gods. And I think it's essential for us as we try to, my argument here is we need to shepherd the return of the strong gods. And in so doing, I think it's essential that we restore domestic stability and marriage. And there's a political dimension of this, tax policies and employment policies and so forth. My view is I think we should revisit no-fault divorce. There's cultural politics here. First principle should be to do no harm. And it strikes me that radical feminism has a tendency to be hostile to even the weakest expressions of male and female roles in courtship and marriage, and that this contributes to the weakening of marriage in our culture. And then LGBT ideology denies the male-female difference altogether, and this also creates problems. So just as we need a national conversation about who we are as a nation, as a people, we also need a sober conversation about what it means to be a man and a woman. And we need the conversation that's not policed by the late decadent expressions of the post-war consensus. As the strong gods return, we need to resist the divinization of political ideology, which is a typical left-wing temptation, as well as the over-sacralization of the nation, which is an historic right-wing temptation. And the consensus in places like UVA is to combat these temptations with the various strategies of weakening that I talked about earlier. But these strategies are losing their power, as I think populism indicates. A more reliable approach is to encourage genuine religiosity and devotion to objects of love that are higher than temporal affairs. So we should encourage biblical literacy. And I think a general education requirement of philosophy for secondary schools and at universities is a good idea. It's not trying to get people to become members of religious communities. Instead, I think it's a gain for social health and human fulfillment if citizens have their eyes on higher things, at least to some degree, on higher things. Now, as a Catholic, I'd like to see a widespread revival of Christianity in the West. And perhaps that will happen. But in the meantime, we need to wake up to the peril of a society without transcendence. Before 1945, most liberal writers and leaders recognized that a healthy political culture depends upon the vitality of communities of faith. They typically identified the moral discipline inculcated by religious communities as a key ingredient of a healthy society. That's important, but more important, I think, is the combination of rest and restlessness that religious faith provides in the modern era. Rest, there's a kind of consolation that faith provides in the face of injustice, suffering, and death. And this makes religious believers stable and stalwart citizens, less likely to be inflamed by ideological promises that are surrogates for true religion. Now, it sounds paradoxical, but a strongly transcendent faith actually grounds a person, doesn't it? I've got a transcendent faith ground a person, but that's the effect it has. But it also encourages a certain kind of restlessness. Faith gives one a foretaste of true peace and perfect justice, and this will motivate believers to take active roles, not simply to sustain the body politic, but to remediate its ills. In that sense, religious communities are salt and light and engines of reform, even as they stabilize society. But my point is just broadly systemic. Public life, domestic life, religious life, these are what Russell Hittinger has called the three necessary societies. It's my conviction that the strong gods will return most fiercely in the public realm, revitalizing the nations. That's already underway, it seems to me, in the West. It's more obvious in Europe than the United States, but I think that's already underway. And let's not imagine we can weaken the strong gods of public life with the old therapies of disenchantment. Better to encourage a cultural, spiritual system of checks and balances. For family and church can limit the strong gods of the nations. Family from below, church or communities of transcendence from above. False and debasing loves are best cured by true and ennobling loves. So I want to conclude by emphasizing, to sort of drive home, I think, for you the importance of the return of the strong gods in public life, which as I've submitted, is it's the driving force of our political turmoil in the present. Their return and all of the angst that it's creating. So, when I moved to Omaha, Nebraska in the 1990s, I joined a church that was formed by the merger of an all-black parish and an all-white parish. At some point, one of the church leaders, an accomplished black man who had recently retired, arranged an event to watch the showing of the Tuskegee Airmen, a film about an all-black flight squadron in World War II. And they were required to serve in a racially segregated unit, and they trained in the Deep South, where they were subjugated to the humiliations of Jim Crow. Now, after the film ended, the man who had arranged the screening stood to lead the discussion. He said, with tears in his eyes and an agonized voice, "How could we have treated those men that way?" Whew. Twenty years ago, still affects me. At the time, I was thunderstruck by the ingathering power of the we. I mean, after all, the fellow who had arranged the screening was old enough to have grown up under segregation. Nevertheless, he felt that he was implicated in the racial injustices done in his own lifetime. It was an arresting and a clarifying moment for me. The strong gods bind us together in many ways. And this is a solidarity that's often joyous and sometimes agonizing, but it's always precious. Now, it's the job of a leadership class of a nation to defend and promote the gift of the we. At this late date, however, far too many elites cannot bring themselves to speak warmly of the we. This is undermining their legitimacy, and rightly so. The upshot is a populism that, for all of its ignorance and excess, is essentially correct. It intuitively senses that the crisis of our time is one of frayed solidarity, not racism, sexism, xenophobia, or some other moral crime. This populism also sees that our civic life is not coming unraveled because of protectionism, high taxes, or too much economic regulation. So I am more and more convinced that our political upheavals reflect a profound failure of our governing consensus, which is shared by Democrats and Republicans. Places like the University of Virginia educate us to believe that our highest duty is to prevent the return of the strong gods. In the 21st century West, this is profoundly wrong-headed. Insofar as our present leaders insist upon ever greater openness, fluidity, and flux, they will bring woe and not peace. For absent opportunities for true and ennobling loves, of which patriotic ardor is surely one, people will default to demagogues and charlatans who offer them false and debasing loves. So, I would say, in conclusion, that our job is to restore public life in the West by developing a language of love and a vision of the we that befits our dignity and appeals to our reason as well as our hearts. We need to become patrons of the strong gods, the ones who come from above and animate the best of our traditions. For it is my conviction that only that kind of leadership will forestall the return of the dark gods who rise from below. Thank you.
We have time for questions.
Okay. Before we start the question and answer period, I'd like to mention that immediately after that, we will have a reception just behind these doors up in the corridor. So please join us for that. Teresa, do you want to lead the question?
It seems to me that, at least on one superficial level, both the right and the left have these kind of narratives of the inevitability of inclusivity. So for the right, it's that capital is always seeking more, and so that's going to lead to global markets, and then manufacturing goes to Asia, and manufacturing will then go to Africa, and artificial intelligence will just let more and more people into the wealth game, right? So it's like very materialistic. Then on the left, you have the we you talk about is just land-owning white men, and then it's white men, and then it's women, and then it's black people, and then it's more women, and then it's gay people, etc. That's like more, it's less materialist, but it's both that history is just both in different ways going towards we, like a new we. So what is the truth in that? And then like, how is your we different than those we's? And what do you think
There's a kind of shared utopianism of inclusivity. The market's going to include everyone eventually in the great cycle of prosperity. And then multiculturalism is that with the right sort of rebalancing of cultural power, everyone will be in the sort of charmed circle. Nobody will be on the periphery because there will be no center. I think that's very correct. And both of them are anarchistic. They're both anarchist utopias because there's no arche, there's no guiding, there's no God, right? There's no, in that Durkheimian sense. And of course, the argument there is that, the shared we is humanity. I don't think that, as I said, you know, I was born human, right? But my name is Reno. And part of the we that's precious is the we turns what is contingent into something more significant than what is universal. So, right? I mean, so I'm willing to sacrifice things for the particular we, whether it's my nation or my family, that run against my instincts. So this kind of self-transcendence is really only possible through the love, that power of love. And I just don't think humanity does that, has that capacity. Because that's just taking the universal and making the universal it does. There's no element of particularity there to galvanize. I mean, I've said in other fora that there is no global common good, I don't think. People say human rights, global rule of law, the international order. Okay, I'm willing to concede maybe that's too strong of a statement, but they're very weak common goods.
Do you think that obligation conflicts with interest when subjects and issues are considered secular to God? Because in the occupation or business of education, it always seems that humanity seems to reach a high state of reprobated thinking when it comes to teaching and learning in order to contemplate the thinking of God.
Right. We have our interests, and it seems to me modern political life has sought a politics of interests and not a politics of dogmas or, you know. So that's in the sense that we, and I think that's fitting and appropriate, but can only go so far. It does need to be this sacred element in I think, any moral community, whether it's the moral community of the family or a university or a nation, precisely to evoke that from us capacity for self-transcendence, where we transcend our interests. We want a liberal society where that's not a regular demand. You know? Original sin being what it is, it tends to be a law of entropy. There needs to be kind of new moral energy. I think new moral energy comes from this these sacred sources.
Your comment about there being no global common good, or at least that being only a very thin layer, doesn't that also apply to the modern nation state? It's a bit thicker, but still very thin compared to the polis, the traditional idea of a close-knit community of people who actually in some way know each other. I mean, haven't we sort of stripped most of the possibility of common good just simply by aggregation of people into classes of hundreds of millions?
Yeah, no, this only comes up when I talk about these topics. 330 million people, I mean, come on. And I just got to say, I'm always astounded by our country. It is a thing. It is a race. There is something that we share. And people feel it very acutely. And it's totally improbable, you know, that it would be the case for 330 million people. And it's not true for everyone. There are some people who are alienated, and they're bitter their own. It's like people are often, some people, their relation to their family is just nothing but a source of unhappiness. But for most of us, for the supermajority of Americans, it's actually warm. Feelings are warm, not cold.
Can you get super rather large modern?
I don't know, Germans, I mean, I've been to China, but I have no sense of that there. Language is a powerful thing. It's a very powerful thing. But, you know, I didn't feel it until I went abroad and as a young student, some students, and I did my study summer language thing in Germany, and I went, wow. I had all these individualistic fantasies, and I realized, oh, no, 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 I'm just such a typical American. You know, which is kind of humiliating if you're an Emersonian, but of course that's part of our self-delusion as Americans. So I'm an optimist. I think we can have a national conversation about who we are, that it's possible to have that conversation. It never ends, but it's possible to have it and have it be a strengthening and not a weakening one.
The back there.
Yep. Yes. Would you say that the arts and humanities over the last century, whether it's the great books or some other sort of manifestation, is a type of amelioration, a type of weakening, as opposed to something strong?
So you think, like Matthew Arnold, as has been thought and said, as a kind of complete bloodless surrogate for the living God?
Well,
is that what you're driving at?
If you have arts and aesthetics, maybe there's a bit of a sleight of hand in the substitution that's taking place.
Yes. I mean, I think that's perceptive. And I think that art as a substitute for religion was a very powerful impulse in the late 19th and early 20th century. It was a very elite phenomenon. And it was an attempt to find a new strengthening discourse, a new strengthening source. As opposed to after 1945, there was an active effort to find weakening conversations and not strengthening ones. So you could say, yeah, you know, Matthew Arnold, Walter Pater, they, you know, yeah, it's thin beer, which I agree, it is thin beer. That was my reaction when I read it, those guys in grad school. But as I've gotten more young, thin beer is a lot better than no beer. You know, as opposed to whatever the cod liver oil that we've been getting in education for the last couple of generations.
Thanks. Much to think about. I want to raise a historical point that leads to a practical question. What you describe sounds a lot to me like the Christian Democratic Project in Europe after in the early post-war years, that of course also spread to Latin America. Not completely, not solely Catholic. There were, you know, the Dutch version, the German Protestant version, but largely out of Catholic Europe. And in Italy, for example, the Christian Democrats had a little trouble putting themselves under American agenda because they didn't trust the United States as this liberal European sense, market-based economy, atomized society. They didn't like, but it was better than communism. And so we made a pact with the Christian Democrats and party in over Europe, and they took hold. They ran a lot of these countries for a while, and indeed, European integration comes out of that movement. Now, since then, it's evolved. It's not what it was in the days of Adenauer and so on. And that leads to the question of why would this succeed now in painting the strong gods? Because that sounds, it's almost like the language they use, right? These hideous, you know, subterranean gods, communism, fascism, need to be painted. And the way is not Anglo-Saxon liberalism, it is through the true God, right, and the church and so on. So what it didn't, you know, it had a good run, but it seems to have fallen apart. So that's the question.
Right, the Christian Democratic movement was, you know, it's Catholic in Europe, and they were, right, they drew down on, I would say that they drew down on a very deep reservoir of moral and political solidarity, and they didn't recapitalize. I think that their primary anxiety was to prevent, you know, the return of Hitler or Mussolini. And you're correct that they're very nervous about Americans, and we imposed on them probably a more atomizing liberal outlook than they actually wanted, but they accepted it, especially the Germans and their Grundgesetz, because you know they had to. But I've come to see things in terms of trajectories, you know. So was Konrad Adenauer, were his instincts of solidarity greater than, I'm sure his instincts of solidarity were far greater than the most right-wing politician in Europe today. But I think his instinct was that that needs to be carefully guarded against and maybe weakened. Whereas the right-wing politicians today in Europe are saying, no, those instincts of solidarity need to be strengthened. So even though they themselves often, they don't even know what that means because it's all been so disintegrated over the last two generations. So it's the trajectory that I see as what's important. My grandparents, my parents, they all in their own way were on board and with the moderate open society imperative towards opening things up. And I think I've come to see that my own adult life has been an increasing discomfort with that imperative, first religiously and then increasingly more culturally, politically. But certainly religiously when I was in my 20s, wait a minute, Christianity doesn't, at some point it's not Christianity anymore. if you wind up talking about Christ as an event, no, he's a person. Or the meaning of the resurrection as opposed to the reality of the resurrection. So meaning versus truth, all that stuff was percolating in my brain in my early 20s, late teens and early 20s, when I realized, no, all those weakening strategies winds up evacuating Christian faith of its power. And so I became a conservative theologian in that sense. Similarly, I think what, as we know, certainly in the European context and increasingly in the American context, I think conservative will mean people who are in favor of, and that is the more traditional European mode, which is to be in favor of authority, these kinds of notions. In America, a distinctive country, and so our loyalty to our the strong gods of the American polity that involves a strong loyalty to liberty, So we have this paradoxical national culture, and part of which can never be stabilized. I don't think we should try to stabilize it. Instead, we have to have a generation renew it in a kind of humane form.
A couple of big things ago, our president stated rather forcefully that all life, unborn or born, is created in the image of God. Am I hopelessly naive, or maybe naively hopeful, to regard that as a calling forth of a lead at the fundamental level that you're talking about?
Yeah, if I would have written a speech, I would have strengthened those themes around that. The duty we have to each other, to protect the innocent. And then also with the woman who was, whose sentence was commuted, that when people transgress, we have to punish them, but they're not cast out of the moral community. That we have a covenant with all of our fellow citizens, even people who transgress at the in a profound way. So I would have emphasized the we even more. So I think people are very hungry for it in 2019. But I was glad he said it, that's for sure.
Since we kind of were looking to sort of see the revival of strong gods, vis-a-vis the church and the family, but also perhaps even in the nation state as well, one of the challenges facing us is that I think there are too many weak men at the helm of these three sectors of our society. So, do you have any thoughts about how to, you touched on this issue of women and men in your talk, but do you have any thoughts about how to revive, a certain kind of masculinity for our moment?
Well, that is a kind of a big question. And I do think that in some ways it's more foundational than these questions about our kind of national story and to who we are. It is more foundational. Because when the male-female dance breaks down, everything breaks down. And so a repair of the male-female dance is hugely important. And that's not just men figuring out how to be men again. It's also women figuring out how to be women again. And because takes two to tango. So I do think it's a reciprocal breakdown. And it has many, many sources. And I think, forget the blame. I mean, I said my jabs at radical feminists, but to a great extent, forget the blame game and the question. Just like I think, you know, arguing about whether Charlottesville should have Confederate monuments, that's not a bad thing to argue about. It's just not the most important thing. At some point, we need to move forward and actually talk about who we are, who we want to be. And I think young men and women need to talk about, you know, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. And these are not easy questions. They never have been easy questions, I would submit. And certainly the national question of the United States has never been an easy question, you know, given the Civil War and other less bloody but equally traumatic and fraught times in our nation's history. So I guess that's not answering. You want more specifics, I know. You probably know better than I do what the answer to that question is, Brad.
So President Obama's second inaugural address painted a very powerful picture of the gay rights movement sort of being the fulfillment of the promise of the Declaration. So sort of what you're offering is not just a project that's going back to, but it's actually a debate and a response to what the other side is already doing.
No, I think that's a great observation. Obama's actually good on the we, although he tended to frame things as that's not who we are, as opposed to that's who we are. But nevertheless, he had a good intuition and sense, and his speechwriters had a good intuition and sense that one of the primary functions of political leadership is to formulate answering to the question of the we. And I always admired that in him. The problem is that, you know, the liberation projects on their own are negative, I think, right? There's a removal of impediments, breaking down of boundaries, overcoming of limits, and so they don't have the same consolidating motifs that I think are necessary. Although, like I said, King did it. I mean, his argument was that the we is falsified if it doesn't include Black Americans, and so. You know, the LBGT thing, I guess I would want to say, at this juncture, I would want to say, well, like, who's not included? And, I mean, well, yeah, who's not included? And at some point, what would it, you know, it becomes a kind of instrument of weakening and not strengthening. I mean, part of the problem, I think, we have politically is that the center, or what I would call normal. Normal is it's under assault in many ways, and that this is meant to sort of break things down so that there's more fluidity and motion in our society. It's more porous. It's more flexible. It's more accepting. It's more affirming, and so on and so forth. But that breaking down of the normal, I think, is part of the cultural problem that we have, which is reinforced by sort of economic stresses on the middle. It's also cultural stresses on the middle. I'm not sure I can be fully articulate about that, but I feel that pretty strongly.
We have time for one more question.
It occurs to me that when you talk about substitute knowledge, strong effort. We're really talking about a cultural commitment.
Yeah.
And that to identify the we is to find out what culture we can share, what definition of what is good, what is right, what is true, what is beautiful, and that sort of thing. It constitutes a culture. And it seems to me it's hard to be optimistic. If we define the problem that way, because there are such fundamental differences in cultural elements, it appears to me
raised in, during the Great Depression in an immigrant community in New York. And for all of the differences there, there was a certain commonality, a certain sharing that doesn't exist now. It wasn't that hard, you know, a Polish neighbor and the settled Jewish neighbor and the Greek neighbor and so on. We had a certain shared commonality that we could talk about, or we in a real sense, that I think is evaporating now. And I thought I heard you say before you're optimistic, and I'm wondering where comes your optimism?
It is funny that in the Bronx or Brooklyn or where was it?
Well, it was in a lovely area that was called Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah, so Hell's Kitchen.
Which I understand is very expensive to live in.
Everything's expensive. It's funny that in Hell's Kitchen, you would think that those people you described would be profoundly divided and separated from each other, but they were actually, there was a sense of a we there. Partly it was the stress of the time drove people together, and then of course the war, which made people come together even more. And I think we've been eroding, or we've been deconsolidating ever since 1945. In some cases, good deconsolidation. But nevertheless, it's gone a long way over the last 75 years. And why am I optimistic? Because populism suggests that people don't want to be alone. That's just the bottom line, is that, you know, if you come to UVA and you go to your freshman orientation and then you go to your classes in the humanities and maybe some in social sciences, you would think that, there's no hope. But I think this is a leadership problem and not a problem for most people. You know, and I don't think it's just an age thing with the fellow at my church in Omaha. It's not just that he was, you know, 70 years old at the time and grew up under different experiences than young people today, but I travel around and talk to people. They want to be part of something. For most Americans haven't really accomplished very much in their lives, and a lot of people have made a real mess of their lives in today's environment because there's so much, the moral guardrails are down. And for them, their citizenship is a very precious thing, and they're very proud of their country. And that goes across really a wide variety. I don't see that limited by yellow, brown, or black skin, that feeling of pride and the desire to want to be, to want to strengthen those bonds. So I don't see that as a, so at least my experience is there's a hunger for it. And the thrust of my speech is that if we don't satisfy that hunger, then bad people will. Charlatans and demagogues will. And so it's my hope that our political leaders, who are very keen on political survival, will adjust. And there's some modest signs of adjustment, it seems to me. Certainly on the economic sphere, there's a lot more solidarity talk now, both in the Republican side and the Democratic side, than there was even 3 years ago. Now, some of those policy suggestions, I think, are misguided. Free college for all, that's a giveaway to the top 30%. That's not what we need. Plus, it was also probably pervert higher education even more. But the impulse you see behind these, or universal basic income, which I think would be disastrous. I think people want to be a productive members of society, not wards of the state. But be that as it may, those, what I think, bad policy impulses are, they're responding to voters who are saying, we want a system where it's just not me floating in this kind of sea of uncertainty, and I want to be part of something where I'll take care of other people, people take care of me. So that's what gives me optimism. I think this is a great time to run First Things magazine. 2018 was a great year. I mean, in the sense that people want to think new thoughts about public life. Not so much about theology, because we tend to know, I think, what even there, I think, in the Catholic Church, a lot of turmoil is getting people to think fresh, in a fresh way. But certainly in the political world, people know that the ideas that they really thought, you know, pretty solid, you know, I kind of know where I stand on economic policy and other issues, they're starting to think, now, wait a minute, you know, maybe I should be rethinking and think in a more deep way. And so, as a result, it's been exciting to run the magazine because I'm just more and more aware that what we're publishing is actually feeding people's desire to think more deeply and again about their civic commitments. And again, that strikes me as that's a sign that, you know, we're not just going to careen off the edge of the cliff. We're going to make an adjustment and try to figure out how to muddle forward, which is the way life always works in politics. Thank you.